Part 2, Chapter 3. The Sin Against the Holy Spirit, The Secret of Mary Despised, 1960. A unanimous and fervent wait. It cannot be denied that at the dawn of 1960, apart from the handful of Jesuits and other progressive intellectuals who were obstinately, hypocritically anti-Fatima, and feared this eventuality more than anything, everybody confidently awaited the upcoming publication of Our Lady's final secret. In November 1959, Father Richard, who at the time directed the French section of the Blue Army of Fatima, announced without the slightest hesitation, 1960 will be the year when the final secret of Fatima must be revealed. He reprinted a long article, a very remarkable one at that, by one of the best Portuguese experts, Father Meixas Dias Coelho, completely devoted to the importance and probable contents of the third secret. Father Richard wrote, "It seemed interesting to us to summarize an article by Reverend Meixas Dias Coelho, a professor at the Seminary of Fundão in Portugal. This article appeared in Mensagem, with an imprimatur. The author has the intention of clarifying the secret of 1960, to prepare us for its revelation, whatever it might be." Father Dias Coelho, who had just published his great work on Fatima, had no doubts whatsoever about the upcoming publication of the secret, as the introduction to his article attests. If it was only a question of much ado about nothing, this would already be sufficient reason for dealing with the matter, at least with the purpose of quashing these rumors. But in reality, testimony on the existence of a third part of the secret of Fatima, the first and second part having been published already in 1942, is so weighty, coming from persons like Don José, Bishop of Liria, his successor, Don Venancio, Cardinal Sir Gira, and Cardinal Tisserant, that it leaves no doubt. Also, we can use, as an unquestionable fact, this assertion of Dr. Galamba de Oliveira, in 1953, in Fatima, Altar do Mundo, the third part of the secret was sealed in the hands of His Grace the Bishop of Liria, and will be opened either after the seer's death or at the latest in 1960. In the beginning of January, 1960, A Voz, the Royalist Journal of Lisbon, also announced the publication of the secret. On January 5, these lines appeared in the Madrid journal ABC, under the pen of its Roman correspondent. "For the moment nothing is known, but already the world press, especially the Italian press, reflecting the curiosity and anxiety of millions of Catholics, is asking when the famous document will be opened and made public. Many are already assuming that it will coincide with the commemoration of the first apparition of Our Lady, that is, on May 13. Before long, Radio Fatima communicated the following, without the slightest commentary. "Yesterday, Mr. Giuseppe Gyrico, director of the Revue Grazia of Milan, accompanied by a photographer reporter, was at Fatima to procure information on the upcoming revelation of the secret. The news had spread all over Christendom, and the pastors most informed about the grave dangers of the hour hoped that publication of this final secret of the Queen of Heaven would be the occasion of extraordinary assistance granted by God to the Church and the world. Here is what our father, the Abbé de Nance, who at the time was pastor of three humble parishes in Champagne, wrote to his friends on the occasion of the New Year. I wanted to write to you my wishes for the Year of Grace 1960, year one of the expansion of world communism according to the declarations of its leader, also the year of the revelation of the last secret of Fatima. I have put off writing this letter, too heavy with fears and at the same time charged with a great hope. As we rise above the strange passions in which the papers and party men seek to lead us, the coming year can easily be foreseen. The great movements of thought which hold power will continue their accelerated expansion, which is literally terrifying, unless, prepared in the secret of the Church of God, which prays and immolates itself without letting up, some supernatural event comes to reduce to naught the vain thoughts of the wicked. Pessimism, optimism, no. It is Christian wisdom, which dares to measure with precision the forces of Satan, but with faith opposes to them the power of the invisible Spirit who animates our Holy Mother the Church. At the dawn of 1960, as still today, 30 years later, The forces of Satan still have these same two faces which our father denounced back then, that of communism and that of its accomplice, a progressivism supposedly Christian. What terrifies us first? Obviously communism, which persecutes the church. Its red stain grows larger on the map of the world, and fortified by its success, it casts its tentacles upon a new continent which the West seems to abandon to it, Africa. It has been said over and over that its military force alone could not explain such an expansion. It is its power of seduction, which is truly diabolical, that allows it to take hold of immense regions of the world without firing a shot. On the one hand, the underdeveloped peoples allow themselves to be taken in by this subversive dialectic which the West itself invented, and on the other hand progressivism and its multiple currents of ideas even here consider communism not as an enemy of our civilization, and our religion, but as a brother movement. An event near at hand marks this complicity, Khrushchev's visits to France. This welcome, which is senseless and odious, leaves the clergy and elite of the country almost indifferent. If all Christians, all civilized men saw this evil with the same eyes and a true resolution, it is certain that a blow stopping this decomposition of the world and its great Christian empires would quickly be struck, and without great cost. The drama was the treason spreading within the church itself. In this general orientation of the Catholic elite, there is on the one hand this mental perversion of progressivism, which leads people to see in these insurrections, where Christians, Muslims, pagans, and communists are mingled, a sort of new biblical, evangelical march of humanity towards the promised land and the city of God, and on the other hand a certain candour joined with the most reprehensible blindness, through which they imagine that they merit the privilege of complete liberty for the church in these new worlds. In this spirit of dizziness which is seducing the Catholic elite and masses, there lies such a power of delusion that I no longer expect the saving miracle except from the Church herself, waking up her children. Will it be the third secret of Fatima which must be revealed next May 13th? Will it be the Council? Apparitions or some extraordinary event? All this is possible, and heaven is close enough to earth to make the necessary help appear before our dazzled eyes. But to the extent that events precipitate themselves, will not the miracle be that, by the dozens, and then by the thousands, from the most perceptive to the entire people, everybody purifies himself in prayer and the study of every ferment of heresy, discord, or cowardice, and then run to the defense of the city of God, assailed on every side? This miracle of the conversion of hearts was even more a conversion of minds. They needed to be purified from the venom of error, which was beginning to poison an ever-increasing number of poor souls led astray by bad shepherds. Nothing would have been more effective for this purpose than the prophetic words of Our Lady herself, warning the Church of the gravest danger threatening it at the dawn of this new decade. I a bewildering decision, the secret of Fatima will not be revealed. In this atmosphere of expectation, of simple curiosity among some, but supernatural confidence and holy hope among others, suddenly came the announcement from the Portuguese news agency ANI at Rome which sowed the greatest disillusionment in the history of Fatima and one of the greatest injuries to Fatima's reputation. February 8, 1960, the communique of the news agency ANI. According to Vatican sources, February 8, 1960, the secret of Fatima will never be disclosed. It has just been stated, in very reliable Vatican circles, to the representatives of United Press International, that it is most likely that the letter will never be opened, in which Sister Lucy wrote down the words which Our Lady confided as a secret to the three little shepherds in the Covada area. As indicated by Sister Lucy, the letter can only be opened during the year 1960. Faced with the pressure that has been placed on the Vatican, some wanting the letter to be opened and made known to the world, others, on the supposition that it may contain alarming prophecies, desiring that its publication be withheld, the same Vatican circles declare that the Vatican has decided not to make public Sister Lucy's letter, and to continue keeping it rigorously sealed. The decision of the Vatican is based on various reasons. One, Sister Lucy is still living. Two, the Vatican already knows the contents of the letter. 3. Although the Church recognizes the Fatima apparitions, she does not pledge herself to guarantee the veracity of the words which the three little shepherds claim to have heard from Our Lady. In these circumstances, it is most probable that the secret of Fatima will remain, forever, under absolute seal. This simple text from the news agency was a real bombshell. In the Church's history, it perhaps weighs a great deal more heavily than the five bulky volumes of Discorsi, Messaggi, Colloqui of His Holiness John XXIII, where of course it does not appear. Still, it is Pope John XXIII who unquestionably assumes the primary responsibility for the announcement. He had read the secret 5 months earlier. He had decided not to divulge it. This press communique revealed his unexpected decision. In spite of some hypothetical circumlocutions purely for form's sake, it was clear that this decision was irrevocable. This text, which moreover was very badly composed, left not the slightest doubt on that point. The Vatican has decided not to make public Sister Lucy's letter, and to continue keeping it rigorously sealed. A text unworthy of the successor of Peter. This decision was in itself stupefying. It was going to cause a great deal of surprise, indignation, or even scandal among the faithful. John XXIII had chosen, or at least agreed, to make it known to the world in a roundabout, doubly anonymous manner. It was the doing of the Vatican, of Vatican authorities, without any precision. Nor had anybody assumed responsibility for the disclosure. It was not attributed to any cardinal, to any department leader, to any Roman prelate, it has just been stated, to the representatives of United Press International. This was tantamount to saying, the Vatican has decided, the Vatican has declared to the press, nothing more would be disclosed. Why this double camouflage? Why all the mystery? For a very simple and compelling reason, if a cardinal or some prelate had pronounced this declaration, immediately he would have been asked the embarrassing question, where did the decision originate and what were the motives for it? He would have had to answer, and everybody could have judged the plausibility of the reasons put forward in an official text emanating from a responsible authority. The most complete anonymity was intended to elude this insurmountable difficulty. The faithful had to be content with a vulgar, cold press communique without any traceable origin or definite guarantee of authenticity. Yet, in spite of this bizarre, deceitful procedure, unworthy of the successor of Peter, it was clear for every informed reader that this communique emanated from the highest spheres of the Vatican, that the text had undoubtedly been at least checked by the Holy Father himself, and that the decision not to divulge the secret came directly from him. Cardinal Sirgira highlighted the point on February 24, 1960. According to the dispatch which has been published, and I am convinced of the veracity of what it states, meaning, its contents really do express the Pope's thinking, this document, the third secret, must be at the Vatican, and His Holiness must be aware of its contents. Besides, not only was the press communique never denied, but it turned out to be the only text emanating from the Vatican to justify not publishing the third secret. Neither John XXIII nor Paul VI deigned to give the Church a single sentence of explanation on the subject. They never made the slightest explicit reference to the secret of Fatima. The world had to wait until 1967 for Cardinal Ottaviani to approach the question again, and we shall see in what astonishing manner he did so. These facts demonstrate the importance of this dispatch from a press agency in the history of the Third Secret. It also shows how scandalous was the evasiveness of the Sovereign Pontiff, covering himself under the most shameless anonymity to reveal to the faithful his decision as Supreme Pastor on such a grave subject, so close to the hearts of his finest children and so closely touching on the honor of the Mother of God. He had made the decision, but refused to publicly assume responsibility for it, and the rude blow it would have caused to his popularity. Was this not already implicitly recognizing the arbitrary, unacceptable character of this desire to bury forever, in indifference and scorn, the final secret of the Queen of Prophets, a secret intended beyond any question to be revealed to the world? A mass of incoherent statements, inexactitudes, and lies. Apart from the categorical and peremptory statement according to which Our Lady's final message would never be disclosed, that it would remain forever under the most absolute seal, what unbelievable audacity in this unjustifiable decision, everything in this Vatican communique, we are forced to state, seems vague, incoherent, and even false. 1. The communique states, it is most likely that the letter will never be opened, in which Sister Lucy wrote down the words which Our Lady confided as a secret to the three little shepherds in the Covada area. In vain was this declaration attributed to very reliable Vatican circles, it is false or at least ambiguous since we know that John XXIII had already opened the envelope in August 1959. 2. As indicated by Sister Lucy, the letter can only be opened during the year 1960. What does that mean? Sister Lucy had never said such a thing. The truth is that she had made Bishop da Silva promise that the secret be divulged immediately after her own death, or at the latest in 1960. 3. The communique goes on to state that the contrary pressures exercised over the Vatican had led to its negative decision. But this too is simply a false pretext, for in the end, on the one side there were the Blessed Virgin's specific requests passed on by her worthy messenger, there were the promises made public by Bishop da Silva and Cardinal Sergira to divulge it in 1960, and finally there was the great hope of the whole Church. On the other side, there was the tiny minority of adversaries of Fatima, who went on the supposition that it may contain alarming prophecies. Placed in these circumstances due to such contrary pressures, did the Holy Father appoint a commission of cardinals to examine the question? No. Did he announce that he had very attentively read the text of the secret and taken it into consideration as he governed the Church, while waiting for a more opportune hour to make it public? No again. We know only that, faced with these contrary pressures, the Vatican resolutely adopted, across the board, the position of the enemies of Fatima. It even took the trouble to mention their infamous, but purely gratuitous supposition, according to which the secret might contain alarming prophecies. One wonders why the Pope had to take into account this supposition, since he himself had read the text, as we are informed a few lines down. Behind this lamentable incoherence perfidy lay hidden, if the Pope, after reading the secret, had given in to the demands of Fatima's adversaries, was it not because he shared their disdainful opinion about the secret's contents? Was not the secret nothing more than alarming prophecies? In any case, Rome gave free rein to this hypothesis, which destroyed the reputation of the seer at the same time as it ruined the credibility of the message she had passed on. The three reasons for not publishing the secret. The text of the communique continues, the decision of the Vatican authorities is based on various reasons. Writing in Mensajum de Fatima, Father Stein immediately condemned these reasons as absolutely unfounded and ridiculous. Alas! The judgment is severe, but perfectly exact, as we will show. 1. Sister Lucy is still living. It is true that there had been a question about the death of the seer in the declarations related to disclosure of the third secret. But nothing in these declarations allowed the conclusion that the secret could not be revealed in 1960 if Sister Lucy was still alive at that time. Here is what had been agreed on at the beginning: when His Grace the Bishop refused to open it, Lucy made him promise that it would definitely be opened and read to the world at her death or in 1960, whichever happened first. The third part of the secret will be opened either after the death of the seer, or at the latest in 1960. Hence this clause mentioning the seer's death could only speed up the revelation of the secret. It is inconceivable how the Vatican could possibly invoke it to delay this date. Father Alonso justly remarks, the fact that Sister Lucy is still living does not seem to us a valid reason for not revealing the secret. First of all, Sister Lucy is still sufficiently protected, outwardly by the cloister and inwardly by an extraordinary fortitude, from all the assaults of public opinion, no matter what their source. Besides, this would not have been the first or the most important occasion on which she had to endure serious harassment on account of her writings. The fact that Lucy was still living had not prevented publication of the first two parts of the secret, and nobody saw why it should be any different for the third part. Besides, The proof that this reason was only a vain pretext is found in the communique itself, since it is stated at the same time that the secret will never be disclosed. Even after Lucy's death? Even after her death, it will remain, forever, under absolute seal. Here is an initial, completely artificial reason, which hides other reasons which undoubtedly cannot be admitted. 2. The Vatican already knows the contents of the letter. This is precious information, but in itself it cannot justify the decision not to divulge the contents. On the contrary, could not, should not the knowledge of the secret have led the sovereign pontiff to make it known to the entire church, in conformity with heaven's will? A third motive is alleged, which in the final analysis is the only real one, all the others being only vain, incoherent, and clumsy pretexts. Here then is the key phrase, the poisoned arrow of this Vatican communique. 3. Although the Church recognizes the Fatima apparitions, she does not pledge herself to guarantee the veracity of the words which the three little shepherds claim to have heard from Our Lady. Here is a motive unbelievable in its tenor. Not only does the Vatican make its own the untenable position of Father Danny's, but it dares to go even further, it is on the entirety of the message, the words which the three little shepherds claim to have heard from Our Lady, that the communique casts the most infamous suspicion. At the same time that it was forced to state that the Church recognizes the Fatima apparitions, although it is utterly unclear in what such a recognition can consist. The Vatican publicly discredited all the revelations of Fatima without exception. True, it was in a miserable press communique whose juridical authority was nil, and whose content was worthless. But the whole world knew that this paper, which was never denied, emanated from the Holy See. One can guess the anguish and immense sadness felt in Portugal in the wake of this communique, especially since in this question which concerned them in the highest degree, neither Sister Lucy nor Cardinal Sergeira had been consulted. 2. The Portuguese authorities despised. I affirm categorically that I was not consulted. On February 24, 1960, the news came out in the Portuguese Catholic daily Novidades that Cardinal Sergeira had not even been consulted. The Patriarch of Lisbon had himself declared to a journalist of Diario de Noticias. In what concerns the last part of the secret of Fatima, His Eminence said, I know little or nothing. Whatever I know I learned through the dispatch from Vatican City printed in the papers. I see that it is a question preoccupying the whole world, letters on this subject reach me from the most distant countries. Question, but didn't the secret have to be revealed in 1960? What I know is that Lucy, with whom I have never discussed it, wrote the secret in a letter given to the Bishop of Liria, at that time Don José Correa da Silva. The latter sealed it in another envelope, on which he indicated that the letter had to be opened in 1960 by himself, Bishop José Correa da Silva, if he was still alive, or if not, by the Cardinal Patriarch of Lisbon. This is what was told to me by the Bishop of Liria, who remained the custodian of the letter. Question, what became of the letter after the Bishop of Liria's death? I sincerely do not know. I have heard nothing said on this subject. According to the dispatch which was published, and I am convinced of the veracity of what it states, this document must be at the Vatican, and His Holiness must be aware of the contents. Question, but didn't Lucy herself make it clear, and we think that it was the will of Our Lady of Fatima, that the secret had to be revealed in 1960. It is common knowledge that Lucy has had new supernatural manifestations. Consequently, I can say nothing concerning the opportuneness of divulging the secret. I know nothing, and I affirm categorically that I was not consulted on this subject. What I did know of its non-disclosure in 1960, I learned through the papers. According to Monsignor Capovilla, John XXIII asked for advice from a dozen or so prelates on the subject of the third secret. If this is true, it is even more stupefying that the person who had the right to be consulted before anyone else was deliberately shut out. Was it not written on the envelope of the secret itself that it had to be opened by the Cardinal Patriarch of Lisbon? Advisors or accomplices? This shows us to what extent the consultations of John XXIII, to the degree they really took place, were already calculated. There was no consulting. There was no asking for advice. Favorable opinions were gathered for a decision already made. In short, it was a question of looking for accomplices. The first accomplice in this lamentable, scandalous affair where Rome lied so brazenly was undoubtedly Monsignor Capovilla, the private secretary and very skillful, influential advisor of Pope John XXIII. He avows it himself, "John XXIII frequently conversed with me about Fatima and the devotion to Mary spreading from there all over the world." He also includes himself among the figures the Pope spoke to about the third secret. He himself transcribed the note written by John XXIII after reading the text. Curiously, he knew the names of the prelates John XXIII consulted. He knew where Sister Lucy's manuscript was placed later on. At the very moment when he appears informed on everything, which leads the reader to think that he was no stranger to the decision taken, he dares to justify it by a patent untruth. Nobody ever said that the document had to be made public, sic. Nor can I explain why the conviction spread, why it had to be published. This is astonishing, all the same, at the Vatican. And there alone. They were ignorant of what all Christendom knew for 15 years. It is incredible. The Romans sometimes have an astonishingly short memory, even to the point of forgetting the definition of a lie, and its seriousness. This leaves a lingering doubt on the seriousness of other statements in Monsignor Capovilla's plea for his master. Thus he has every interest in diminishing the responsibility of John XXIII, and his own, by saying that the Pope humbly requested advice from very many figures, whose thinking all went in the sense of non-publication. I never heard that anybody advised its disclosure. I have the impression, all the same, that at the Vatican the opinion prevailed that it was proper to respect the reserve adopted by Pius XII. The secretary of John XXIII is decidedly fond of ambiguous expressions. The opinion prevailed, he tells us. Was everybody not in agreement, as he otherwise would have us believe? Were certain prelates consulted in favor, then, of quite simply obeying Our Lady's requests and divulging her secret? This is probably so, and perhaps one day we will learn their names. However, precautions were taken to make the consultation selective. Thus Cardinal Koenig, Archbishop of Vienna, who was surely one of the most suspect and disastrous bishops of the conciliar and post-conciliar period, was able to boast to Cardinal Sergira, "The Pope told me the secret of Fatima." The Patriarch of Lisbon had not had this favor. He later confided to Father Caelan, "I do not know the secret. One time Pope John XXIII spoke to me about it vaguely, in a distant fashion, and I understood that it concerned very grave matters." This response of Cardinal Sergira appears very enlightening to us. According to Monsignor Capovilla, Monsignor Seymour was also aware of the secret. Yet, the latter denies it. Everything is explained if John XXIII contented himself with speaking to him about it vaguely. The Bishop of Lyria, "I can say nothing." Similarly, we know that Bishop Venancio was received in audience by John XXIII, in the months following the opening of the secret, undoubtedly in December 1959. The Pope surely spoke to him about the third secret. Yet, Bishop Venancio always stated that he had never read it. He reaffirmed it to me at Fatima, on February 13, 1984. In any case, his attitude in 1960 leaves it clearly perceptible that the Roman decision was contrary to his wishes. On May 12, 1960, on the occasion of the pilgrimage, Father Richard was able to question him on the subject. Father Richard published an account of the interview in L'Homme Nouveau of June 5. Bishop Venancio asks only one thing, that nobody talk to him about the secret. On that point he is like a tombstone. Also, it is now generally admitted that the famous envelope was placed in the hands of the Holy Father, who himself must have passed it on to the Holy Office, that its contents are presently being examined, and that it is not at all inconceivable that His Holiness John XXIII, at the desired time, and in his own way, which is very simple and not earth-shaking even for great things, might tell us what we ought to know. Perhaps it is indicative that in response to an homage from the Bishop of Lyria, he just sent a telegram which is a pressing exhortation to the accomplishment of the message of Fatima. The pressing exhortation to accomplishment of the Fatima message was, in reality, rather short. The Pope contented himself with saying, as in the usual type of telegram, that he sent his blessing to the pilgrims as a pledge of perseverance in their resolutions to practice the message of Fatima. Bishop Venanzio declared to a journalist of the Italian review Oggi. You want information on the secret, my answer is no. I can say nothing, nor can I indicate where the letter is, nor tell you if it has already been opened, nor when its contents will be communicated. At present, it would not be opportune to speak about it too much. We will see later on that on May 17, 1960, after observing that Rome had done nothing on the occasion of the anniversary of the first apparition, Bishop Venanzio had taken, without informing the Pope, an unusual and courageous decision to try to move heaven, and undoubtedly also to make the Vatican break its silence. For officially, Rome still had not dared to say a single authoritative and responsible word on the third secret. What in reality was powerlessness to justify an arbitrary act seemed to be, in the public's eyes, the mark of a supreme disdain regarding Fatima. Bitter disillusionment. Simple folk, notes Father Alonso, waited up until May 13 when it was believed that the revelation would be made. Later, people felt a profound disenchantment and disappointment which did great harm to devotion to Our Lady of Fatima, both inside and outside Portugal. 3. The Lies of Father Capril, June 1960. Would Rome continue to keep silence? On June 18, 1960, Father Giovanni Capril, S.J., published a long article in Civiltà Cattolica entitled, Fatima is a Secret Not Revealed. Although this article lacked any official authority, it was later put forward as the Vatican's defense. This text has the same long-winded style as the communiqué of February 8. We will quote the essential passages here, interspersed with our comments. 1. A morbid anxiety. Among certain people, the approach of May 13 provoked a sort of anxiety which we would not hesitate to call morbid, in the expectation of that day, the day of publication of the secret of Fatima. The press did not fail to become interested in the matter, thus contributing one way or another to increasing the curiosity and expectation. It will not perhaps be in vain, returning to a subject already dealt with a few months ago, cf. Civ. Cat. 1959, 4, 90-91, to recall the wise prudence and delicate reserve of the Church, which does not encourage new alarmism of this nature, and which alone has the right to pronounce authoritative words on this subject. This argument is at the very least bewildering. Nobody has ever explained to us how this atmosphere of curiosity and expectation, this new alarmism, this morbid anxiety, sick, could dissuade the Vatican from divulging Our Lady's words. On the contrary, it would have sufficed to reveal these words for all the unjustified fears to be dispelled, for all the unfounded new alarmism to be refuted by the very fact. It is the Vatican's silence which caused them. And this silence will keep them going and cause new reactions of this kind to appear. 2. A secret which says nothing. First of all, we make our own the wise remark of the Catholic Weekly of Turin, Il Nostro Tempo, which observed last May 26, the use of the term secret is in general judged improper, at least in its most suggestive acceptation, in this sense that the last part of the Fatima message could also contain merely an invitation to prayer and penance, in the spirit of the apparitions of the Covida Iria. Hence we see on what a fragile basis rest the catastrophic forecasts, inconsiderately spread. The Vatican spokesman was really short on imagination, for if the third secret of Fatima contained only an invitation to prayer and penance, one can no longer understand at all why the Pope so stubbornly refused to divulge it. Nor can we understand why Our Lady had ordered the three shepherds to keep secret a message repeating word for word her public message of October 13, 1917. That just doesn't hold water. Some other reason had to be found. 3. The faithful were promised nothing, and besides, it doesn't concern them. Recently, deploring these alarmist rumors and urging the faithful to place no credence in them, the Diocesan Weekly of Porto, a Vaz do pastor, concluded, "We know nothing concerning Sister Lucy's letter, we do not even know if the Pope has occupied himself with the matter. Nobody ever promised that the secret would be published, it might very well be a message or a recommendation to the hierarchy. In this case the matter would not concern us, and we would have no reason to get agitated." NCWC, News Service, April 25, 1960, dot. Two arguments, two patent falsehoods. 1. Nobody ever promised that the secret would be published. We have quoted the public declarations of responsible persons, Sister Lucy, Bishop da Silva, Cardinal Sirgira, which unquestionably had the value of promises. A certain audacity was needed to dare assert the contrary. Let us remark in passing that this is literally the false version presented by Monsignor Capovilla. 2. As for saying that it might be a recommendation to the hierarchy, the testimonies from 1944 to 1960 all deny this hypothesis. We have shown that nothing, absolutely nothing, allows us to state that the final secret of Fatima was reserved exclusively to the Pope. 4. Contradictory rumors, sensational news. Already in February, the rector of the Sanctuary of Fatima, Monsignor Antonio Borges, had declared, "As at the time of the apparitions, the people are at present eager for sensational news which is prejudicial to the true message." In reality, immediately after the last war, Sister Lucy gave Bishop da Silva, who is since deceased, a letter which, according to him, contained something which had to be read in 1960, if she was not dead before this date. Since the death of the bishop in 1957, church authorities have observed a prudent reserve, by reason of the contradictory rumors circulating, refusing to make any declaration concerning this letter and its publication. NCWC, News Service, February 15, 1960. In April, the press service of the sanctuary, praising those who strive heroically to fulfill the message of prayer and penance left by the Blessed Virgin, added, "Simple and generous souls do not let themselves be troubled by sensational news which agitates the world concerning the third part of the secret of Fatima." NCWC, News Service, April 11, 1960. To those who were waiting for a declaration from the present Bishop of Liria, Don João Pereira Venancio, who said last year that the letter would be opened in 1960, but that he didn't know by whom, or where, nor if the contents would be made public or not, Monsignor Borges remarked that opening the envelope was one thing, and its publication was something else, a subject on which it really wasn't possible to say anything. NCWC, News Service, March 28, 1960, dot. It is remarkable that Father Capril, instead of developing an argument step by step, is content to make a disorderly accumulation of all the disparate and contradictory explanations expressed here and there to excuse Rome's silence as best as possible. He dwells here on the embarrassed, not always exact declarations of Monsignor Borges and Bishop Venancio. Yet, it must be stressed that the same arguments do not have the same meaning on the lips of the one and the others. When the sanctuary authorities strove to justify the unbelievable Roman decision whatever the cost, they were clearly doing so against their better judgment, because of the obedience due to the Pope. They were intimately persuaded, wrongly, it seems to us, that this was the only attitude possible for them. When these same reasons, lacking all validity, were repeated at Rome by a knowledgeable Jesuit in Civiltà Cattolica, known to be an unofficial organ of the Holy See, it was an imposture. Father Capril goes on to quote several declarations from bishops, which add no positive element to his confused plea. 5. The true grievances against Fatima. As he widens the scope of the debate, our Roman Jesuit finally arrives at the essential point: Fatima displeases those in high places, notably because of the anti-communism which it stirs up and approves. Sister Lucy herself is responsible for this too exclusive interpretation of the message. as for certain interpretations of the message of Fatima in an almost exclusively anti-communist sense, and as for the impatience of certain people in the face of the Church's prudent reserve, we do well to take into consideration the following observations excerpted from a clear and weighty article by Father Balick, President of the International Pontifical Marian Academy. This too exclusive interpretation, which is at the basis of certain initiatives, has caused a great number of people carried away with enthusiasm at the passage of the venerated statue to remain deaf to the Madonna's first request, which is an invitation to conversion of heart and the renewal of morals. The enthusiasm of the crowds, which can have many explanations, has at times carried away those who should have enlightened souls on the true significance of the message. We are alluding here to certain writers, definitely in good faith but not always prudent, for whom everything said or written by Sister Lucy must be considered strictly as a heavenly revelation. Such exaggerations easily lead the faithful to deviations, inciting them to attribute more importance to a private revelation than to Holy Scripture and the teaching of the Church. As if certain revelations passed on by Sister Lucy could be interpreted contrary to Holy Scripture and the teaching of the Church. Father Balick is incapable of furnishing the slightest example, but once the perfidious insinuation was made, it was to produce its deleterious effects of mistrust and scorn for Fatima. 6. The authority of the Church is the sole judge. An example of these deviations is offered to us by certain priests and lay people who, requesting publication of the third part of the Fatima message, are unsparing about criticizing Church authorities in various ways. They forget that it belongs to the Church not only to watch over and interpret revelation, which ended with the death of the apostles, but also what is connected with it, precisely as our private revelations. Only the ecclesiastical authority, invested with this power, has the right, then, to judge whether or not it is opportune to stress a private and secret revelation. We do not deny it. Yet, the case of Fatima is particularly clear. In 1960, it was evident that the Church had already recognized the divine authenticity of the apparitions, to the point where no informed Catholic would have dared to publicly question it at the time. After the two prelates responsible, His Grace the Bishop of Liria and the Patriarch of Lisbon, promised to divulge the integral text of the secret at the latest in 1960, and given that for over 15 years no authoritative declaration had come to deny these promises, the faithful were perfectly right to request this promised disclosure from the supreme authority. Besides, the revelation of the first two secrets in 1942, with the approval of Pope Pius XII, constituted a precedent. At least they had a right to an exact and honest explanation on the part of the Holy Father. This is why it was normal that the lies of the Vatican authorities on such a grave subject should be a cause of scandal for them. 7. A threefold, disturbing secret. The teaching of the Fatima message, as a pressing moral exhortation, is already clear in the two known parts. It is the motherly invitation addressed by Mary to all humanity for it to return to Christ, through prayer and sacrifice. So we should preoccupy ourselves more with what is known than with what is still secret. Let us remark that out of his deliberate desire to ignore the third secret so as to keep only what is known, the author in fact comes to empty the first two parts of the secret of their real content. Father Balick sees in them only a moral exhortation, to prayer and sacrifice. This leads us to believe that he never read the authentic secret, which contains something entirely different, the vision of hell, and the Immaculate Heart of Mary proposed as the final salvation of souls and Christendom. The precise requests and promises of Our Lady, as well as the prophetic announcement of terrible chastisements, are all wiped out from the message by the President of the International Pontifical Marian Academy, and by the Jesuit of Civiltà Cattolica, who quotes him approvingly. Father Balick then recalled the example of John XXIII, who on the occasion of the consecration of Italy to the Immaculate Heart of Mary on September 13, 1959, said not a word about Fatima and the secret. Father Caprile concludes by repeating the major theme of his article. These few notes are sufficient to make us understand what the Church's thinking is, and consequently what attitude we should take. Neither fright, nor alarmism, nor sentimentalism, nor morbid curiosity. This was saying nothing. For those who awaited, who requested disclosure of the secret were not animated by any of these feelings, unduly blown up by the enemies of Fatima to serve the needs of their evil cause, but only by faith and trust in Our Lady. To conclude his plea and round out his potpourri of quotations, the Roman Jesuit wrote. A French Catholic weekly has written excellently, an article appearing in La France Catholique of May 13, 1960, where Georges Deat, after quoting the Chancery of Coimbra's declaration against Father Fuentes, believed it pertinent to conclude thus: it is more important to respond to the message of Fatima than to know its secret. No true children of the Church will behave otherwise. The formula sounds good, but it is a gross sophism. For whoever is familiar with Fatima knows that the secret constitutes precisely the essence of the message. As for dissociating the third part from the preceding two, experience has shown how illusory this is, and we shall return to this point. What has taken place since 1960 has cruelly refuted the hypocritical invitations, which were just talk, from Fathers Bailic, Capral and Company to practice with greater fervour the first two parts of the secret, while as yet in ignorance of the third. In reality, the discredit brought against the final secret would inevitably rebound against the entirety of Our Lady's warnings. It is certain, on the contrary, that its disclosure would again have drawn attention and aroused trust among the faithful for the two parts already known, and even the public message of 1917. In his recent work, John Hafford himself insists on the deplorable effects of the Vatican's decision. 1960 came and went, and the Pope, to whom the secret had been confided, did not make it public. He did not even make known the fact that he had opened it. The silence from Rome lay heavily on all of us. People began to murmur that Fatima must have been a fake, that there was no secret, that the 1960 secret was a hoax. In 1964, the effect of the long silence concerning the 1960 secret still seemed to hang over us like a pall. That was exactly right. To bury the third secret meant, in reality, burying Fatima with it. Had the Bishop of Lyria sensed it? Had he foreseen the disastrous consequences of Rome's silence? 4. The final attempt of Bishop Venancio, May 17 to October 13, 1960. On the day after the pilgrimage of May 13, the Bishop of Lyria made a courageous decision. He would speak directly to all the bishops of the world without asking anything from the Pope, whom he was content to inform later on. When we consider how naturally self-effacing and timid Bishop Venancio was, and how he believed it his duty to obey punctually, blindly, no matter what orders he received, it is astonishing to see him take such an initiative, which is most unusual in the Church's annals. On this occasion he demonstrated the ardent faith animating him, and how much he feared the grave supernatural consequences of Rome's scornful, cavalier attitude to the Mother of God's messages. Undoubtedly he had also been encouraged by Sister Lucy. Since the Pope, during the audience he had granted him in December 1959, had undoubtedly asked for absolute silence on the third secret, Bishop Venancio did not speak of it. Yet, nothing prevented him from recalling the striking truth and importance of the second secret's prophecy concerning Russia. Letter to the Catholic Bishops of the Whole World, May 17, 1960. Fatima, May 17, 1960. Excellency. On this day of the first anniversary of Portugal's official consecration to the Holy Hearts of Jesus and Mary, may one of your most humble brothers in the episcopate be permitted to speak to your excellency to present you with a request. As Bishop of Lyria, I am entrusted with the sanctuary of Our Lady of Fatima, and in recommending myself on this title, and on this office which is so heavy for me, I dare to open my heart to you and to hope for your cooperation. A double threat, war and the expansion of communism. The anxiety of the whole world before the fragility of peace, and even more so, the anguish which grips far-sighted Christians before the menace of the expansion of communism, sufficiently explain the numerous appeals coming to me from everywhere urging me to intensify the movement of prayer and penance born at the Covid-era, especially in view of the conversion of Russia and peace. a special effort of prayer and penance in the spirit of reparation. Still under the powerful emotions of the spectacle of the immense penitent crowd that gathered at Fatima last May 13th, and more conscious than ever, for my part, of the responsibilities which His Eminence Cardinal Lurcaro recalled that day to all the pilgrims in his homily, faced with such a clear message given by the Most Holy Virgin 43 years ago, I have resolved to ask the people of my diocese, and the other pilgrims who will come to Fatima next October 12th and 13th, for a special effort of prayer and penance, in view of a more perfect return to God. I will ask all those who can really do so to end the pilgrimage on foot, to recite the rosary during at least the last few kilometers, and to spend the entire night from the 12th to the 13th adoring the Most Holy Sacrament, in reparation for so many sins, a cause of affliction for the Sacred Heart of Jesus and the heart of our sorrowful and Immaculate Mother. To make up for the evil which is triumphing and the indifference of so many Christians. But how could the intervention alone even of a million pilgrims, burdened with their own spiritual miseries, sufficiently compensate for such a great evil which is triumphing in the world, and the indifference of a multitude of Christians themselves, who neglect to have recourse to the Savior and His Holy Mother, to obtain the triumph of the cause of God? Hence it occurred to me to solicit the help of my brothers in the episcopate. Perhaps it will seem to you opportune, Excellency, to pass on my humble request to your people, and to suggest to them similar exercises of prayer and penance, in union with all the pilgrims of Fatima. In this way, next October 12th and 13th would be genuine World Days of Prayer and Penance, to obtain the triumph of the cause of God. At Fatima, Cardinal Lurcaro recalled, Our Lady has crowned the centuries-old history of her merciful interventions, asking that there be consecrated to her Immaculate Heart the world, evil as it is, and particularly Russia, whose errors are spreading everywhere, and whose persecutions cause anguish to the Church. For peace through the conversion of Russia. May we not hope that bishops, priests, and the faithful everywhere, joining with one heart and with renewed fervour, in the consecrations already accomplished by the Sovereign Pontiff, will contribute to removing the obstacles which may have prevented these solemn acts from obtaining their full efficacy, for the conversion of Russia, so dear to the Mother of God, and for obtaining a real peace. A final request. I would be very grateful to Your Excellency, if you saw no difficulty, for you to entrust somebody with the task of sending me, for the common edification, a little account of what may have been done, in this sense, in your diocese. May Your Excellency deign to pardon the simplicity with which I have let my heart dictate this letter, and accept my sentiments of profound respect and complete union in the hearts of Jesus and Mary. John, Bishop of Lyria. This letter was a humble request addressed to all the pastors of the Church, and through them, to all the faithful. At the same time, it was a profession of faith in the unquestionable authenticity and importance of the Fatima message for the salvation of the whole world. By making an urgent invitation to pray and do penance in the spirit of reparation for offenses against the holy hearts of Jesus and Mary, and to obtain a true peace from heaven through the conversion of Russia, the Bishop of Lyria also intended to obtain from the Pope a response to Our Lady's precise requests. By requesting a written account of whatever was done in each diocese, he undoubtedly wanted to gather a vast documentation to press the Pope to invite all the bishops of the world to join with him, to finally perform the consecration of Russia as the Blessed Virgin had requested. By requesting all the bishops for genuine World Days of Prayer and Penance to obtain the triumph of the cause of God, the Bishop of Fatima demonstrated how grave the hour was for the Church and for the world. For the triumph of the cause of God had to be obtained first at Rome itself, at the Vatican, where the infamous communique of February 8, 1960, had scandalously discredited the apparitions and message of Fatima. Clearly, Bishop Venancio was attempting a final initiative to lead the Sovereign Pontiff to correspond, at least on some point, to the Blessed Virgin's requests. On October 13, the anniversary of the last apparition, a final hope remained. For the Pope it could be the opportunity to repair the grave scandal caused by not revealing the secret. Besides, seeing how the crowds of pilgrims at Fatima knew how to impose on themselves courageous acts of prayer and penance to respond to the Fatima message, would perhaps the Holy Father's heart finally be touched? Would he then, perhaps, reveal to the world the secret of Our Lady? Bishop Venancio at the Vatican. On July 10, Father Richard wrote in L'Homme Nouveau. It is still too early to know the repercussions of this act of the Bishop of Liria. Its significance and importance cannot escape anybody who wants to take the trouble to reflect. What we already know is that many responses have arrived from all countries, and even from beyond the Iron Curtain, that the princes of the Church have given their full adherence, and that recently, for the second time in 6 months, Pope John XXIII has granted an audience to the Bishop of Liria. Bishop Venancio, then, had requested a second audience from the Pope. Undoubtedly the purpose was to give him the text of his letter and ask the Pope to himself address the order to all the bishops to perform, on October 13, an act of consecration of the world and Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. What was John XXIII's response? We do not know. But at the beginning of September, he gave grounds for hoping that he really would do something. An act of John XXIII for October 13. On September 7, there appeared in Novidades, the Portuguese Catholic daily, a communique from the Information Service of the Sanctuary, SIS, whose text was as follows. According to a communication received from Rome, His Holiness Pope John XXIII manifested the intention to renew, next October 13, the consecration of the world and especially Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, in union with all the bishops of the world, as Our Lady of Fatima requested. He would do so using the formula of consecration composed by Pope Pius XII, SIS. This note was reprinted in the Religious Bulletin of Porto, a Voz do Pastor of September 10, and on the 12th Novidades stressed that it was officially published by the Sanctuary of Fatima. September 28, John XXIII's letter to Cardinal Micura. At the approach of the month of the Rosary, in a letter to the Cardinal Vicar for the City of Rome, the Pope recommended recitation of the Rosary, and at the same time insisted in his turn on the gravity of the hour, writing, "We have no illusions. Just as at so many other times in history, since there is nothing new under the sun, Eccl. 1:10, the world is going through grave, very grave, and dangerous hours. At stake is the historic vocation of peoples, the eternal destiny of each man created according to the image of God. We do not usually lift the veil from the miseries and threats of ruin grasping at the heart of him who has the sacred duty to watch over and defend the family, social and religious order. But the statistics are there, alarming in their cold enunciation of facts presented to the public by informed and competent specialists, a general hatred for life, a frenzy for domination, a subtle but obstinate initiation to error, which determines, with anti-Christian theories and spirit, the structure of systems of social life of the masses, who are fed with counterfeits of the truth. You know, Eminence, how much all this must inspire fear for the spiritual, religious, and social order in those who, like the Bishop of Rome and all those who share his pastoral preoccupations, live through it, suffer from it, and are vividly preoccupied with it before the Lord and before souls. We will return to this text in which, it seems, we can discern a vague allusion to the third secret of Fatima. But was John XXIII really disturbed, convinced of the dangers menacing the Church and the world? Only the future would tell. A perfidious article in L.A. Croix. Thinking that the Pope was going to do something, on October 4, Lacroix finally devoted an article to the Bishop of Liria's initiative, October 12-13, Prayer for Peace with Fatima. After quoting some excerpts from Bishop Venancio's letter, the editor, François Bernard, took advantage of the opportunity to add some reflections based on his own beliefs, and we can guess in what sense. Prayer and penance, this is the whole message of Fatima. We must confine ourselves to this, he explained in substance, adding perfidiously. It would be misleading to want to expect something else from the visions Lucy and her little companions Francisco and Jacinta had. Excessive speculation around a secret which, it is said, could be revealed this year has unfortunately turned attention away from the essential. He goes on to quote at length the hazy article of Father Balak already mentioned, to conclude. The appeal that comes from Fatima does not ask us to turn towards Fatima and fix our eyes in expectation of some kind of apocalypse, but to turn to God. The Holy Father has just lifted his voice, on the eve of the opening of the month of the Rosary, to invite us, in this very grave and dangerous hour the world is passing through, to take refuge under the protection of her who is the help of Christians and the Queen of the Universe. October 13, 1960, Fatima under the tempest. The long-awaited pilgrimage, to which hundreds of thousands of the faithful all over the world united themselves, was, more than ever, a pilgrimage of penance and sacrifice. It began on the evening of October 12, in the midst of a storm of winds from the southwest, accompanied by sometimes violent showers. The torchlight procession took place under the pouring rain. The bad weather was prolonged all through the night. In conformity with the request of Bishop Venancio expressed in his letter of May 17, and setting the example, Cardinal Sirgira and the bishops present spent the entire night in adoration. Thousands of pilgrims imitated them. On the morning of the 13th, at the moment of the General Communion Mass, celebrated at 6:30 by the Cardinal Patriarch of Lisbon at the high altar of the Basilica, the storm redoubled its violence and the wind seemed to want to carry everything away, while the rain battered the pilgrims who had not been able to find a place in the Basilica or in the outside galleries. Nevertheless, 48,000 of the faithful, of whom many had spent the entire night in prayer exposed to the rain and wind, received communion inside the Basilica and on the wet esplanade. At 9:30, a statue of St. Louis Marie Grignion de Montfort, which now stands above the colonnade of the Basilica, was blessed and inaugurated by His Excellency the Bishop of Liria in the presence of 400 Belgian and Dutch pilgrims, having at their head the Superior General of the Montfort Fathers. Around 10 o'clock, the esplanade began to be covered again with compact masses, reciting the rosary, now battered by a northwest wind, which fortunately, little by little dispelled the clouds. Finally, the sun appeared in a sky which was calm once more, when the statue of Our Lady of Fatima left in procession from the Capilinha to take its place, at 11 o'clock, at the outside altar of the Basilica, at the top of the monumental staircase. At this moment, the number of pilgrims could be estimated at between 300,000 and 400,000. Many had come on foot, often barefoot, and the medical assistance post had to take care of close to 1,500 people whose feet were injured during the rough and long journey which had led them to the Covada area. In other words, Bishop Venancio's request to finish the journey as far as possible on foot, and saying the rosary in the spirit of penance had been generously followed. After the Gospel, Cardinal Lurcaro commented on Lucy's words to the crowd on October 13, 1917, "Look at the sky." The words had been somewhat modified for the needs of the homily, for Lucy had shouted at the time, "Look at the sun." On this subject Father Richard, who was on pilgrimage to the Covada area again, makes a judicious remark, writing, "No doubt some pilgrims came expecting the privilege of being the first to hear some information on the famous secret. Others came with the hope that some extraordinary sign would mark the pilgrimage of the year 1960. If faith and the expectation could really create their object, the sun probably would have turned at Fatima, especially since the tenacious rain of an entire night recreated certain external conditions of the famous day of October 13, 1917. But on this sad day of October, 1960, nobody saw any signs in the sky. On the contrary, our author reports, the wind continued to blow violently right up to the end of the ceremonies, noticeably disturbing the officiants of the pontifical mass and troubling the voice of the loudspeakers. The written accounts do not even mention, as 6 months earlier during the pilgrimage of May 13, the presence of white doves at the feet of Our Lady, which however had been so frequent during this year 1960. After the pontifical mass came the Eucharistic benediction of almost 500 sick people, sheltered under one of the galleries of the colonnade. Then all the prelates present renewed the consecration of the world to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, using the formula composed by Pope Pius XII. The two cardinals and the bishops surrounding them gave their blessing to the crowd of pilgrims. Finally, the Bishop of Lyria read the text of the telegram sent by order of the Sovereign Pontiff, granting the apostolic blessing to all the pilgrims of Fatima, to all those who are united to their prayers and sacrifices, in these days of filial devotion and expiation in honor of the Mother of God. What disappointment! A simple telegram. John XXIII had remained insensible to all the requests addressed to him, the final secret of Our Lady would not be revealed. He had not even deigned to do what had surely been promised Bishop Venancio at Rome, a renewal of the consecration of the world and Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary by the Pope and all the bishops in union with him. For these days of prayer and penance, to which hundreds of thousands of the faithful had been united all over the world, he had not even consented to pronounce a radio message to the pilgrims. No, nothing of the sort, but a simple telegram from the Secretariat of State. Father Richard, in L'Homme Nouveau of November 6, in vain showed off an overflowing enthusiasm, for his plea is hardly convincing. Fatima 1960 was not just the crowd filling the immense esplanade of the Covada Aria, it was the entire church spiritually gathered around a world capital of supplication. Yes, millions of the faithful, all over the world, communicated in the same ardent supplication. If many Catholics remained indifferent, or were not touched, at least, in all countries, there were delegates of prayer and penance, so much so that Fatima 1960 was like a first spiritual mobilization of the Christian people. Granted, Bishop Venancio had received a certain number of responses from bishops. Some were very beautiful. They were published in the French, English, and Spanish editions of Voz de Fatima. But in comparison with all the bishops of the world, they were very few indeed. Father Richard mentions three for France, where in fact the event passed unnoticed, except in 20 or so sanctuaries. However, the most tragic event of this day had been the obstinacy of Pope John XXIII in his resolution to take practically no heed of the warnings and requests of Our Lady of Fatima. Father Richard notes again, certain people hoped for a more precise participation of the Sovereign Pontiff. Indeed, that is the least that could be said. But the president of the French section of the Blue Army concluded all the same. Well, we have the feeling that the pilgrims of October 12 and 13, those who bloodied their feet along the way, the little young girl we encountered coming from Nancy on bicycle, the Cardinal Patriarch of Lisbon and the bishops who gave the example of spending the whole night in adoration, the thousands of pilgrims who remained stoically under the rain from 10 o'clock in the evening until 7:30 in the morning, the millions of others all over the world who also kept watch all through the night, we have this confidence that all together they merited a new respite for the impenitent world, and that they prepared a more total and universal act on which our hope rests. Yes, we are certain that they merited abundant graces for the Church and for the world. We will see, moreover, what a strange coincidence marked these October days in Russia itself, for which the Fatima pilgrims had prayed so much. Yes, they surely contributed to obtaining a grace of peace for the world. V. The Sin Against the Holy Spirit, The Secret of Mary Despised. The editor of L'Homme Nouveau, however, once again showed signs of a false optimism. As if everything could be saved democratically, by prayer alone, by the penance of the flock alone, while the supreme pastor remained insensible to Our Lady's voice, and obstinately refused to carry out the least of her requests. True, in his infinite goodness God would not leave the ardent supplications of his children without a reward, but he was also going to chastise with justice, and in a terrible manner. The obstinacy of their pastors in not entering into his designs of mercy for the world by the sweet and powerful mediation of his most holy mother. The seer of Fatima had foreseen and feared this imminent catastrophe in 1957, the Most Holy Virgin is very sad, because nobody pays attention to her message, she had said then. She went on to explain the gravity of this fault which has incalculable consequences. For in despising the prophecies of Fatima, it was the Blessed Virgin, it was God himself whom the pastors of the church were going to despise, and mock, before the world. Sister Lucy had also declared to Father Fuentes. In the plans of divine providence, God always exhausts all other remedies before he is about to chastise the world. Now, when he sees that the world pays no attention whatsoever, then, as we say in our imperfect manner of speaking, he offers us with a certain trepidation the last means of salvation, his most holy mother. It is with a certain trepidation because, if we despise and repulse this final means, we will not have any more forgiveness from heaven because we have committed a sin which the gospel calls the sin against the Holy Spirit. This sin consists of openly rejecting, with full knowledge and consent, the salvation which he offers. Let us remember that Jesus Christ is a very good Son and that he does not permit that we offend and despise his most holy mother. We have recorded through many centuries of church history the obvious testimony which demonstrates, by terrible chastisements which have befallen those who have attacked the honor of his most holy mother, how our Lord Jesus Christ has always defended the honor of his mother. Had not Pope John the 23rd himself declared, 6 months before reading the secret of Fatima, "In our time the August Mother of God makes her presence felt in human events in a special way, and when from every side the menace of fearsome scourges increases, we feel that in her clemency she intercedes for us, that she implores for us mercy, warding off the chastisements merited by our faults. Hence, one would be placing his own salvation in jeopardy if, when he is assailed by the tempests of the world, he refused to accept her helping hand. This helping hand had been outstretched in mercy, for the final secret of Fatima was just that, a very special help, a supremely effective heavenly reinforcement which the Queen of Heaven offered the vicar of her Son, to obtain light and strength for him in the terrible battles he would have to undertake against the powers of darkness. Alas! John the 23rd had finally disdained this extraordinary help towards a new and terrible chastisement. From then on, was not this black year, which had seen the secret of Mary odiously despised, going to open a new time of chastisement? Our father, the Abbé de Nance, predicted it in January 1961, in his letter for the new year. The year 1960 was, as I predicted to you last January, catastrophic for France, for the West, and for the Church. Khrushchev had announced that it would be year one of communist expansion, and God permitted this general advance of Satan's armies. The predictions of Fatima were not revealed, everything indicated that it is the first of the two branches of the alternative which prevails, the chastisement of humanity, and particularly of Christian peoples, for the depravity of their mind and the laxity of their morals. This chastisement was even more fearsome than all the scourges caused by the startling expansion of Bolshevism prophesied by the Second Secret. We will not describe its nature and tragic episodes right away. Let us quote, however, without any more ado, following our father, who had placed its central verse in the opening quotation of his letter of January 1961, one of the most famous oracles of the book of Isaiah. God does not change, and men, alas, often fall back into the same errors and follow the same tortuous paths that their fathers had followed. Indeed, this oracle, an excerpt from the Testament of Isaiah, applies in a striking manner to the date 1960, so much so that one might have thought it was addressed to the Fatima seer at the end of this tragic year. When applied to the great secret of Mary, it enlightens us straightway, and in what a divine, limpid, and profound manner. On the enigma of its non-disclosure, and on the mystery of its probable contents, which we will now attempt to penetrate. Now go and inscribe this on a tablet, write it in a book, that it may serve in the time to come as a witness forever. This is a rebellious people, they are lying sons, sons who will not listen to Yahweh's orders. To the seers they say, "See no visions," to the prophets, "Do not prophesy the truth to us, tell us flattering things, have illusory visions, turn aside from the way, leave the path, take the Holy One out of our sight." So the Holy One of Israel says, "Since you reject this warning and prefer to trust in wile and guile and to rely on these, then your guilt will prove to be for you a breach on the point of collapse, the bulge at the top of the city wall which suddenly and all at once comes crashing down, irretrievably shattered, smashed like an earthenware pot, so that of the fragments not one shard remains big enough to carry a cinder from the hearth or scoop water from the cistern. For thus says the Lord Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel, your salvation lay in conversion and tranquility, your strength in complete trust, and you would have none of it, is 30:8-15. Volui et no luistis, I wanted to save you, and rebellious to my voice, you did not want to hear me. It is always the same complaint full of anguish and love that God addresses to his people, and more than ever at the end of 1960. For more than ever the prophetic oracle of August 1931 was about to be fulfilled, they did not want to heed my request. They follow the example of the King of France in delaying the execution of my request, and they will follow him into misfortune. These terrible words were pronounced by our Lord after the first refusal of Pius XI. What would it be 30 years later, after so many refusals of his vicar on earth and while the chair of truth had been soiled by so many hypocritical lies intended to keep the truth captive, whatever the cost? God is going to chastise the world, and it will be in a terrible manner, Sister Lucy said in 1957. To what chastisement was the seer alluding? The prophecy of the third secret will allow us to understand. Part 3, The Third Secret Unveiled. Introduction. At the heart of the mystery of Fatima, the final secret of Our Lady. Why speak and write so much about a secret which has still not been divulged? For two very clear reasons. It is the secret of Mary. First of all, to repeat the beautiful expression of Saint Louis Marie Grignion de Montfort, because it concerns the secret of Mary, and the Queen of Prophets never speaks in vain. The two parts of the secret already known to us attest to that. They are so rich, so true, and profound in their conciseness that just the examination of their objective content suffices to show that they are not of man, but of God. We have every reason to think that the third part of this unique secret is at least as important, as decisive for the salvation of souls and the future of the Church and the world. It is a light from heaven, it is a divine grace which it is criminal to neglect, to despise. But there is another, equally compelling reason urging us to draw the attention of the faithful and their pastors to this final secret of Our Lady. Henceforth, the whole of Fatima depends on it. In a word, the message of Fatima is an indivisible whole, and the third secret, since the hour when according to Our Lady's will it should have been revealed, has in some way become the key. With his rare farsightedness as a theologian and mystic, Canon Formigeo, who died a holy death on January 30, 1958, had observed this in 1938. What he said then about the new themes proper to the second secret is equally applicable today to the contents of the third secret. Really, he wrote to Bishop da Silva, the admirable work of Fatima constitutes in its entirety a harmonious, unique, and indivisible whole. Either we admit that divine providence has established it and disposes it strongly and sweetly, with all the elements composing it, or on the contrary, it will be logical to go from excluding one thing to excluding another even to the boldness of denying, moreover against the evidence itself, the reality of the apparitions and the wonderful events, of 1917. This alternative of all or nothing could not be expressed more clearly. It applied indeed to the revelation of Fatima, as to that of the Gospel, to the extent that here also, keeping all due proportion, it is a question of an authentic manifestation of God in our history. This is why, far from being a superfluous appendix, an accidental addition, the third part of the secret constitutes an essential element of the Fatima message, as solidly connected to the other two parts as the first two are inseparable from each other. For in the mystery of Fatima, from the miracle to the public message, from this initial message to the two secrets gradually revealed from 1925 to 1942, and finally from these last two to the final secret written down in January 1944, the connection is so solid that nothing can break any of the links of this golden chain. From the miracle to the message of 1917. Must it be recalled? Fatima is first of all a miracle. It is an extraordinary, incomparable miracle, unique in the entire history of humanity. For never had anybody seen an atmospheric prodigy as undeniable, as striking, a sign so spectacular as this dance of the sun at noon on October 13, 1917, in conformity with the prophetic announcement of the three shepherds expressed publicly 3 months earlier. This extraordinary sign, which we can call apocalyptic, in the strict sense of the term, because it undoubtedly attests to the eschatological significance of the event of Fatima, stamped the divine seal on the cycle of the apparitions, and the entirety of the Fatima message. From the message to the secret. Just as the miracle of the Queen of Heaven leads us to accept her maternal warning of 1917, so also this warning is inseparable from the great secret revealed little by little in the following decades, and finally made public in 1942. In other words, we have sufficiently demonstrated against Father Danny's that between Fatima I and Fatima II, no opposition, no real dichotomy can be sustained. To claim to believe in Fatima I, all the while refusing Fatima II, is adopting the hypocritical attitude of a son who claims to respect and love his mother, while he stubbornly refuses to obey her most pressing requests. For anybody who agrees to be logical, whoever admits Fatima I must admit Fatima II, and conversely, to reject Fatima II leads unavoidably, sooner or later, to casting suspicions and destroying the truth of Fatima I, and finally results in the absurd negation of the miracle of 1917. From the first two secrets to the third. If we go further in considering the mystery of Fatima, we will discover that the bond uniting the revealed secret to the hidden secret, in other words, the first two parts to the third part, is just as solid, just as firm as the preceding links of the chain. In other words, between the final secret, which we can call Fatima III, and Fatima II, the bond is just as unbreakable as between Fatima I and Fatima II. The mystery of Fatima forms a whole. In the last analysis, we are just as certain that the 20 or 30 lines of the third secret really are the very words pronounced by the Queen of Prophets at the Covada Iria on July 13, 1917, as we are certain that on October 13, in this same Covada Iria, over 70,000 witnesses, marveling and seized with astonishment, were present at the most extraordinary cosmic miracle in all history. Since 1960, there are only two solutions. Precisely because of this perfect coherence of the mystery of Fatima, since 1960 there are only two solutions: filial, precise, and eager obedience to All Our Lady's requests, and this act of faith, of trustful docility towards the Immaculate Mediatrix of course presupposes, above all, disclosure of her final message of salvation. The other way is to obstinately keep hidden, at whatever cost, this final and redoubtable secret. This deliberate hiding of the secret, this disobedience to heaven's great designs, then causes the Holy Father to keep his distance from Fatima, to the point of feigning ignorance of its prophecies and the Blessed Virgin's other precise requests. This second way, inevitably, leaves the most odious, the most criminal suspicion hanging over the entire message. In short, because it is a unique secret setting out a unique design of mercy for the world, now that it is completely in the hands of the supreme authority, the Vicar of Christ, it cannot be obeyed worthily and show itself fully, miraculously effective until it is finally recognized as integrally authentic and proclaimed as such by the Sovereign Pontiff. This is why nothing is so important, nothing is so necessary, so urgent as to make this final secret known to the world, a secret buried at the Vatican like a captive truth by successive popes for 30 years. The Blessed Virgin desired its publication in 1960 and Sister Lucy, her messenger, continues to desire it and urgently request it from the competent authority, this we know. As the custodian of a truth feared more than ever, she is reduced to the strictest silence on this most salutary message, to the point where she is practically forbidden to make the slightest allusion to it. The Bishop of Lyria and the sanctuary chaplains also seem to have received orders to keep silence. As for us, nobody forbids us, nobody prevents us from helping to make the Sovereign Pontiff draw our Heavenly Mother's words, finally, out of the deep, dark well of oblivion and scorn into which John the 23rd aimed to bury them forever. No, by the grace of God, for the honor of our Holy Mother, and for the salvation of the Church, these prophetic words will not be forgotten. Since we cannot know the literal content and precise information which, when divulged, will surely be the striking mark of its heavenly origin, at the price of a rigorous and patient investigation we can at least advance very far into the mystery, and already find their light and strength for our journey. May Our Lady of Fatima, the Immaculate Mediatrix, guardian of the faith and victorious over all heresies, guide us and enlighten us in this discovery of her final message of salvation. Virgin Most Faithful, pray for us.